Meeting organizer, by staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Well, the recording, the report you have, I think you can be available. So just ask, just send me a note.
Yes,
and
I
just send
you
a
phone.
And you'll be
in phone. When you're here.
Not anybody in this.
How are you doing?
Ladies and gentlemen, who have called in, this is the Chapter 64E-8, Florida Administrative Code Public Workshop. For the rule revision, just so you know, we will get started in a couple of minutes. I'll probably reiterate this. We've been having some issues with our phone system lately, so if you get dropped, please dial back in and we'll pick you up as soon as we can. This meeting is being recorded. It is part of the public record, just so you are aware.
Bob Benson, Environmental Administrator. We'll leave the line open, so you can mute your phones if you would, please, for any background noise. If it gets too noisy, we'll do a mass mute. And when you speak before the group later on as we get going, please identify yourself.
Hey guys, let's go ahead and get started. My name is Michael Berry. I'm an operations manager at the Florida Department of Health in the Drinking Water Section. You just heard Mr. Vincent. He is an environmental administrator. He is the supervisor of the Water Section. This is a public workshop for Rule 64E8, Florida Administrative Code. It is being held August 6, 2018, and it is now 1 p.m. We'll call it order and just read a couple things. It's on the screen for those of you that are actually here, but it is on your agenda if you have downloaded it. The purpose of this workshop is to receive public comment on Draft Rule 64E-8, Sections 1 through 7, Sections 9 and 10, and Sections 12 and 13, as noticed in the Florida Administrative Register, Volume 44, Number 83, April 27, 2018. This workshop is being audio recorded. The recording will be part of the public record, as will the attendee record and any comments provided to the agency. People who wish to speak, please state your name, spell your last name, state the entity they represent, if any, and please speak clearly. Persons who wish to submit written materials must state their name, spell their last name, state the entity they represent, if any, and clearly state that they wish to submit written materials. Agency personnel will not be available for off-the-record discussions at any time, including during breaks or after the conclusion of the workshop. So a piece of administration, if we get too much background noise, we do ask you to put your mute on, but we do have a master ability to mute, and if we do that, you will need to unmute your phone to make a comment if you are listening in via telephone, and we will tell you how to do that. But right now, all the lines should be open, and so just please mute your personal phone, and that way we don't have too much background noise. We are making changes to the rule. Our legal authority is in Section 381, Section 6, and Section 3 of Florida Statutes, and 381, Section 62 of Florida Statutes, in addition to 403, 862 Florida Statutes. Our objectives are to update and clarify definitions, to make the language more readable. Yes, sir.
Can I stop you? Could you run back to that again? You said a couple of things real quick about the legislation.
Okay. Our authority to make these changes is in Section 381.6, Subsection 1, Florida Statute, Subsection 3A, Florida Statute. These are all written, of course, in the 381, Section 62, Subsection 2A, Paragraphs I and J, and also in Section Florida Statute 403, Section 862, Subsections 1, F, and G.
So
Those are on the agenda.
And those are on the agenda, yeah.
You don't want to
say that. Yeah. Okay, our objectives, as I said, update and clarify definitions to make our language more readable, particularly to non-members of particular trades. Update the effective dates of adopted forms, DH-4092 A and B, and DH-4095. We have draft versions of 4092 A and B. We do not yet have a draft version of 4095. To update the effective dates and internet addresses for the Department of Health advisory level listing incorporated by reference. To incorporate by reference U.S. EPA drinking water standards and health advisories and provide the internet address from which those materials are available. To update the effective dates, the mailing addresses, and internet addresses for the Department of Health, the Environmental Protection Agency, the American Water Works Association, and the United States Food and Drug Administration guidance documents incorporated by reference and existing rules. We're also going to update the effective dates and internet addresses for EPA, FDA, and the National Sanitation Foundation standards that are incorporated by reference in the existing rules. We want to correct our office mailing address and to correct some formatting errors and grammatical errors for consistency. We're going to go down through the sections. Go through the sign-in sheet, first of all. Let's see if anybody has anything there. And we'll start with what's on the sign-in sheet, then we'll go around the room. Yeah. And the specific, I think Mr. Chief was the first person to sign in, so.
I should have
been. Yeah. Please, if you say anything, tell us who you are and spell your last name, and then we'll go from there.
My name is Christopher Teef. My last name is spelled T-E-A-F, and I'm here from Hazardous Chemicals and Waste Research in Tallahassee.
Okay, and what section would you like to start with, sir?
Just at the beginning.
Okay.
The places where I have no comments.
Okay, we'll go down. All right.
So you want me to go through all my comments?
Well, if you want to tell me where we want to start, we can read this thing word for word, but if there are certain areas that everybody wants to focus on, that would probably be more efficient use of this workshop.
That's for each section.
Okay.
And what have the thoughts or comments on section one, and then under the next one after that.
Okay. Well, we'll be certainly. This is my first rodeo, so
I'm certainly not going to be.
We'll start then, I guess, with section one. Any questions on our definitions, sir? Any particular section?
For me.
We've got changes. We have removed the quotation marks among all of them, so that seems to be the new way of doing things. But our first change is contaminant source, definition of that. Any site place that is the origin or that causes or may cause physical, chemical, biological, or radiological substances to enter a well, aquifer, or surface water supply. Okay, we've made some changes, and these are wording changes mostly that the definition should not have changed. We've made some changes to cross-connection, disinfectant, definition of establishment, anybody? Health advisory levels. Okay. The actual code itself is simply adopting the new list,
my question has to do with, in terms of the health advisory level, it's clear that you're referring to the DOH health advisory level.
Correct.
Subsequently, it will come up, I think, that there are also health advisory levels as established by US EPA.
Mm-hmm.
This definition is specific enough that it appears to relate only to the DOH health.
Right.
Not to EPA. Mm-hmm. Got the intent?
Yes. That is the definition of the floor of the other state out. Yes.
There are places where both are discussed in the same sentence, for example. And from a detail standpoint, do you mean to include the definition of the EPA house as well, or simply silent on that issue?
No, we can certainly, we do. Let me go and Mr. C.
Let me ask you the reason why I'm asking.
Yeah.
The initial notification of the meeting was relatively straightforward and simple to just simply adopt the EPA house.
Right.
That seems like maybe we're doing some more things than that now.
The initial intent of the meeting was to, we have updated our state house, and we were going to adopt that new list since this one went back to 2007. So that was a major reason as to having this. We went ahead and added the EPA, and that is, yeah, if the MCL is in section 006, where it talks about if there is an MCL or a HAL that's not otherwise listed, and we find something, and it's on that EPA HAL, we have something we can do. And that was really the purpose of adopting that. We're not using that as a, it's not a routine requirement, similar to our state HALs. It's not a routine requirement for limited use systems to test for them, but if it is found, that gives us the authority to actually say, hey, this is a health problem.
So what you're suggesting, I think, is the health advisory level definition needs to include that, since it is mentioned later in point 006.
Well, we could certainly adopt them in the same, because it's in really section 6 where we do those adoptions, where it talks about chemical levels analysis, and where they, what they shall not exceed. Is that kind of what you're suggesting, is maybe take that out of the definition and move it?
I think because there are two different things that are called HALs, it might make sense to try to be explicit about that.
Mm-hmm.
There is also a question, I suppose, about hierarchy, about hierarchy between one HAL versus another,
right,
between HALs versus MCLs, between one MCL versus another. I don't presume to tell you how to resolve it, but I would say that it's probably a reason to want to look at it from your point of view.
Yeah, and I think unless I am wrong, I mean, your primary is bacteriological lead nitrate, and then the statutory MCLs is defined in the public drinking water, and then the state HALs, and then if none of those apply, then we look at the EPA HALs. That would be sort of the hierarchy.
And that's really what I'm looking at. I'm trying to determine what was the hierarchy, and that is it. The state HALs?
Yes.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Then EPA MCLs or EPA HALs?
MCLs would have, would be above on the hierarchy of than HALs. If it's in statute or if it's required standard, then a regulatory standard, yes, that would have precedence.
I understood right until the very end.
Okay.
So do MCLs take precedence over HALs?
Yes.
Okay. If there is one.
If there is
one. Okay. And then Department HALs take precedence over EPA HALs?
Correct.
And then between state and federal, it's MCLs versus federal MCLs?
It would be the state MCLs, yes, would take I think the state MCLs, with very few exceptions, are effectively the same as the federal MCLs, but state MCLs would take precedent in 552551, I'm sorry.
Okay.
That would be the list we would use.
Okay. And you may have to stop me if your intent is to go through all the sections and then go back, but I mean, I do have some questions about the establishment of the state house.
Okay. We can do that. It's fairly, unless Bob, you think.
It would be good to do that sooner rather than later. That takes a little time.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think we can do that. This is an informal meeting. This isn't a usual hearing, so we can.
Yeah. Understood. I just want to make
we can certainly give some.
Do it in whatever way you all want to do.
And that's perfectly okay, yes. We certainly can.
Can I just ask a question, too, to clarify who you can say? My name is Bill Pence, P-E-N-C-E,
okay.
And I am with Baker and Hostetler in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
But just going on that clarification on this, the hierarchy that's intended to be adopted in this rule, it's the state MCLs followed by the state HALs, followed by the federal MCLs, followed by the federal HALs.
The state MCLs are going to be the same as the federal MCLs, except for, I think, five chemicals, tetrachloroethylene, trichloroethylene, bichloride, benzene, and I forget the fifth one.
Where there are differences,
the state MCLs.
The state HAL would be superior to the federal MCL.
No. If there's an MCL, we'll look at that. And so we would look at state MCLs, because all of the MCLs that are at the federal level are also in the state rule for public water systems. Then, as Mike said, we would use the Florida HALs. And then if there's neither of those, and EPA has a HAL, we would look at that.
Okay, so state MCL, federal MCL, to the extent it's different,
mm-hmm.
then state HALs, federal HALs.
Right, but I don't think that's going to be an issue where we'll have to look at the federal MCLs because the chemicals are the same. They're just, there's five of them that have more stringent standards in the state rule than in the federal rule. And so we would probably wouldn't have to do any variation between that and the HALs. It's going to be, it's going to be an MCL, which is what we have in our state drinking water act, and then the HAL, and that'll be state HAL, and then the EPA HAL if we don't have.
So those would be for existing ones. If the feds come up with a new MCL, that eventually would be adopted, but we wouldn't be able to adopt that right away, nor would DEP.
So I guess now I have a couple questions about the HAL development process. We got your spreadsheets, and by the way, somebody, I think it was you, Mike, probably Kendra, did a ton of work on this. I commend you for that. I mean, that spreadsheet that you put together with the tox values, the existing EPA values, if there's a different one, and an explanation of how you arrived at it is very good. There are a couple of places where it seems like you deviated for one reason or another, and sometimes not easy for me to tell. So let me just ask the question, did you guys use the same formula for the HALs for each chemical on that 323-2018 list? Was the same formula used for all the substances that are on that list?
For the most part, it was. We have most of them, the vast majority we have, whether you're a carcinogen or a non-carcinogen, we use the same formulas and the same assumptions throughout. There were two, I believe, which was the PFO and PFOS, where we used the same formula but factored in some different assumptions as far as water consumption because the primary concern was fetal development and infant, and so we were using, and it's the same, and it is actually the same that the EPA used to determine its HAL for the perfluoro, for PFOA and PFOS. So we used the EPA assumptions, but that kind of deviated from our normal operation, but that should be in there. Those assumptions are in there. I'm trying to think, there may have been, I think those are the only ones we have differed from. That we differ from EPA standard, from our normal. I'm trying to think of any others, and generally we went with what EPA was doing.
There's a couple in there where it's more complicated. It seems like where one is an unknown.
There was one that was unknown, and that was because that was in the list prior to, and I just cannot find. I think the data did come out of the old the HEAST tables, and they're just not there anymore. And that was the only information I had, and I think I know which one you're talking about, and I cannot remember. To be honest with you, I don't think I've ever actually run across that. Let me see.
It's a pesticide.
Yeah, it's one of the pesticides. I know which one you're talking about. I just cannot remember.
The Unicor.
Yeah.
Is that something we need to, this is Kendra Goff, is that something we need to look at maybe removing if we don't really have and haven't seen that?
It may be. To the best of my knowledge, we've never sampled for it. It was an existing HAL that we had on the previous list, and that was the only backup data I could find was that. And so, and I, my guess is that it was on a previous HEAST. Somebody's going to have to help me on that one.
It's in the City Handbook of Pesticides and Agriculture.
Yeah. That was the only documentation I could find for that particular number. But my guess is it was a previous that he said retired. And for those who may not know, and now I have to look it up because I can't remember, the EPA health effects assessment summary tables for Superfund, and that goes back to the early 1990s. They don't use that anymore, but sometimes there's still some data out there that we just haven't been more up to date on.
So do you have a suggestion for what to do with that?
I don't know who on the phone has seen Buticor in their evaluation, but I don't recall having ever seen it.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever even sampled for it.
Somebody's found it somewhere, but I haven't heard.
Yeah. And that number was, that was one of those things I could not find any toxicology data on it other than that one book, and it was a Google Docs book that I dug up.
Some some of these chemicals have not been found in potable water wells in Florida. And, you know, these HALs were created to implement the original Florida drinking water restoration program, where we find a chemical in a private well or that isn't listed on an NCL, and therefore the restoration section at DEP can actually put a filter or hook that private well up to a city water system. So many of these that are on the list were originally put on the list, not because we found them, but because they were within the laboratory method that was being done for that group of chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
This would be an example of one of those.
So it would come up if you use that method.
Right.
And then here's the question, if you find it, what's the number to use for
errors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't feel strong about it. As you went through this, things that raise the question that you all might want to consider in your whatever revisions.
Yeah, that's one way to know the values are iffy. It's the best we have. And I mean, I don't feel real strongly about it either. I don't know about
This is a good time to ask that question because it relates to what was available for. I mean, the most recent thing I can find before this is latter part of 2016. And that was a much, much more extensive list. And I wondered how you decided to go from the 6 or 7 page list to a 2.5 page list.
Because the list in 2016 included MCLs, which would have been copied over from 62550. And they would be on that list. And so it was a combined list. And so this particular list that's here is just it HALs exclusively.
And I'm also familiar with the process that you all conduct with regard to health consultations.
Mm-hmm.
And is there how do you, side by side, how do you look at the health consultations versus the pre-developed HALs? In individual situations, and you do a risk evaluation that in those as well.
I think in most cases these are, at least as far as carcinogens, they are calculated out to 10^-6 as the value as the risk. And when we do a risk assessment, it's well, here's what you've been exposed to, here's the chemical, so here's your risk. As opposed to we're trying to that 10^-6 is pretty much the standard for an effective zero, obviously, for carcinogens, the way it works. You can't guarantee zero, but you can certainly say this is an effective, this is what we're going to choose as far as what's going to be our HAL value and our risk level. So they're basically pre-calculated out at 10^6. Dr. Goff may have a better way of explaining that.
Sure.
This is Laurel Lockett. If you can hear me, for some reason I've lost you.
I can hear you, Laurel, but I can't hear what they're talking about. I think when Dr. Goff maybe got on, but not.
So they cut us off or something?
They cut us off.
It shows I'm still on the call, but I don't hear anything.
Hey, can you hear me? This is Jason.
Yep.
It's the phone system. You'll have to hang up and call back in. It was happening last week also.
All right, thanks.
Hello? Anybody?
Laurel Lockett.
Hey, Laurel. Blessing.
I'm gonna email Michael Berry now and let him know that we got dropped.
Should we call back?
Yeah, I hung up and dialed back in, and I'm still not hearing him, so I'm gonna let him know now.
Yeah, I did too.
Okay, let me. I'm gonna send him an email.
Thank you.
No problem.
But nothing still.
Yep, I can't hear anything either.
It'd be interesting to know if Dr. Goff was there in person or was talking by phone, because if she was talking by phone, maybe that's the problem. When one person talks on the phone, it knocks everyone else off.
I'm going to try and dial in one more time.
Is that you again, Laurel?
No, it's me, Jason, trying to call back in.
Well, Laurel was going to try to call back in again, too.
Yeah,
I'm here.
You're there.
I emailed Bob Vinson and Mike Berry. I'll forward this to Dr. Goff also so she's aware.
Well, this is disappointing.
Oh, just a little bit.
Who are we? Hello?
Hello? Hello?
I wonder what all the beeping is.
People beeping in and out, I bet.
Well, is it just you and I at this point? Who else is on this line?
This is Rick. I'm on here.
There's somebody else, or they left.
I agree. It's probably people beeping in and out. I'm just doing some work. So I'm
waiting for him to connect it back.
That's all I can do. All right, I'm going to put myself on mute.
Is that Rick Mathis?
It is.
Rick, this is Jason in Highlands. Why don't you just go ahead and pick up where they left off?
I know I'm going to mute now.
I've emailed Mike, Bob Vincent, and Dr. Goff. I haven't heard back from any of them yet.
Yeah, I saw other emails as well, so hopefully they'll get someone's and realize it.
Yeah. All right, guys.
All right.
Hello?
Hello?
Is this the workshop for 64E8?
It was.
It was, but we've been cut off. Well, since this is going to be recorded, I think I'm just going to bail and just try and catch the recording.
Hopefully it didn't cut off the recording.
Yep. All right.
Sounds like probably a good idea. All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
All right, folks, technical difficulties. This is Kendra Goff with the Florida Department of Health. We are still trying to call in to make sure that we can get everyone heard in the room. But until that time, we have this on a cell phone. So We will continue on the cell phone, and if we need to, we'll pass the cell phone around.
All right. I'm sorry, everybody. I don't know when it dropped, but I do apologize. This is Michael Berry again. I know Mr. Chief and Mr. Pence and I were discussing the our data sources and our which tier, which hierarchy we were going to use, and to maybe talk about it. That is available for download on our limited use webpage. If anybody needs it, they can certainly email me. And I can send them the link, but that information is there in our standard operating procedure, and our tier one would be EPA's either IRIS or their pesticide database, whichever one had the most recent data.
Welcome to Sun Call Reservation Wisconsin.
And let's see, we've got people trying to dial in right now. Our second would be the peer-reviewed toxicity values. Our third tier would be the ATFDR or California EPA. And then tier four would be, well, anything that would be reasonably current and transparent and peer-reviewed. But they are on available downloads. So.
Thanks for that notification.
Okay. Okay. All right, I'm going to mute.
There, I'm going to mute this right here. But you may want to stay on the line with us. Okay. Okay. Here we are. I'm sorry for the detail. So, but are we good with is that?
Yes. Thank you. That answered my question. And Mike, just to be clear, the technical problems with call-in, does it affect the recording?
It did give us a warning that it was being recorded.
Thank you.
But yes,
it's recording right now. It's recording.
Yeah, it did give us a.
Yes, it says that when you go in each time.
It said it, and if I get that through.
It said it's being recorded. So
when it does shut down, it affects the recording again.
It will.
We've had it record when we actually shut the thing down and record for like 2 days straight or something like that. Oh. We hung up. Yeah, but I did hear it give the warning that you were being recorded. So I'm hoping that.
I'm going to start another recorder.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me ask you another question, Mike, with respect to the tier issues. And maybe now is not the time to go through these one by one. Maybe we end up submitting written comments to you all. When does that process have to be done? The written comments, do you have a particular deadline after this meeting?
I'm not, like I said, first time at the rodeo, but I believe once we get it posted at the next day, it could be
30 days.
Yeah.
30 days enough
from here.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because I think we start getting real hard and fast numbers once we go with the next step in the process.
Okay. Well, let me just give you a couple of examples that I'd like to have you look at and think about, not at this particular moment, but and they have to do with some assumptions or some calculations that go to multiple substances.
Mm-hmm.
One is boron. And boron, we can tell from the information provided that you use a 20% profit source contribution,
mm-hmm.
which was the DEP, the EPA's default for a long time.
Yeah.
But they've always gone with a caveat that to the extent that more accurate information is available, they will use that. And in the case of boron, they now use 80%, which changes the number. Your number is 1,400, which is what DEP's used to be.
Right.
EPA's new RSC, or more recent RSC, is 80%. That changes the number to the way in which it's calculated with the EPA is 5,600, EPA's got it as 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
So the RSC, I guess, would be one where, to the extent there's more information, where EPA has established an alternative fifth source contribution, we would suggest that you use that if you can,
mm-hmm.
based on the argument that newer information is better.
Yeah, we could certainly talk about it and certainly discuss it with the state toxicologist.
And then there's a couple of others. Hexachlorobutadiene is one. Mm-hmm. We don't see it all that frequently, but the department's using it 1987 IRIS TSF. EPA is using it 2003 Health Effects Support Document TSF,
mm-hmm.
which gives you a number that's about twofold different. The DOHL versus the EPA HAL.
Now, hold on. You said now the EPA was using what? Where was it?
2003 health effects support document, which is specific to hexachlorobutadiene. And I recognize right up front that EPA has sometimes all kinds of numbers for the same chemical out there.
Yeah.
And that was really what I was getting at, was when I asked, how do you ultimately decide what you're going to use? If EPA itself has three or four different numbers. No, the answer, I'm asking the question.
Yeah. I don't know a lot, and of course, Kendra can certainly be on that. I mean, we're effectively going on IRIS unless we have better data. But I don't, I would have to look at that. We'd also follow along very closely with the Office of Water would say on that as well, because we're using a lot of their assumptions, a lot of their methods, because we did see, like in Office of Pesticides, they use different intake numbers now and different body weights. They've changed it, and just to keep things as consistent as possible, water sticks with the 2 liters per day and 70 kilograms, whereas I think it's closer to 80 kilograms for the Office of Pesticides.
The last example I'll give you is hexazinone, which is a pesticide that we see from time to time. There's a department using an 87 IRIS RFP, EPA is using a 1994 Office of Pesticide Registration RFP, and that results in about a two-fold difference also. So, I mean, these can be examples that we would provide to you after the fact.
Yeah, that'd be great. That's, yeah. I mean, and like I said, we were there. It looks like IRIS is kind of handing over a lot of that for anything with the pesticide over to OPP. So they would probably be the...
And I wouldn't be surprised if the Office of Pesticide Programs was a more reliable source of that kind of information up to date as compared to IRIS, but it was really a question more than a statement. We just noticed some differences.
Yeah, that'd be great if you could bring that to us. We'll take a look at that.
And I think the Office of Pesticides has a little bit easier time with their review process than IRIS. So that's probably an understatement, but that would definitely be information that we would need and appreciate as other eyes are looking at this.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. And then I noticed also there are a number of places where you all use the age-dependent adjustment factor, which is sort of a not brand new concept, but we're talking about it in the context of 10.7 somewhat with DEP, and I'm just not sure where the agencies are going with that, whether they will or will not ultimately apply that. It does have the effect of reducing the by factor. And
yeah, we looked at that, and we get a lot of following along behind what EPA's Office of Water, and I think the citation's in the documentation there. As far as what they were using for their, as a matter of fact, I think it's on this document right here, yeah, right there, and it is an Office of Water. So we basically used their information, if we had information, if this worked as a mutagen mode of action. And I know at least for some, that was what EPA used for their 2018 and even 2012 health advisory levels, is they did use the age-dependent factors for some. And so we kind of followed that along with that. As the sort of the best practice right now.
Some of the questions I had, you've answered as we went along. So
okay.
It's sort of an unusually efficient process. I guess kind of a generic question. That leads me to ask the question about whether the department is open to the option or the possibility that there may be new toxicological values that come available. Is it your view that those would only be incorporated at such time as the rule is revised? Or if there was
no attorneys have said that you would do it.
But you would
update,
but
re-promulgate, revise.
And that would be the only time in which new toxicological information would get incorporated into the process.
Maybe annually.
Brian and I would probably both laugh at that because we said years ago when 7.7 was promulgated,
you're
induced every year and incorporate new information, it gets away.
Yeah.
But that does happen. With some particularly chemicals that are getting a lot of attention, sometimes the agencies all get together and generate a new consensus value. And it's hard to not use that kind of new accurate information.
No, and I agree, and I know certainly the you asked about the risk assessments with ATSDR and whatnot. And of course, they're a lot more flexible in what they can do. It's just been that as Bob said, our legal wants to make sure everybody's understands when we're making these changes, so we have a lot less flexibility now than perhaps in the past. But certainly in no sort of situation. The perfluoral alkyls are probably a good example of the things that are in flux that we would have to probably look at a lot closer and a lot more frequently than some of the other things that have been around for,
I don't think she's been getting any calls on those two things.
Oh, no.
And this is Kendra, Department of Health, and I think really, especially with the unregulated contaminants list, that really kind of drives any looking at the chemicals of the day, so to speak, and so that'll probably drive the updates.
If you got it would probably be, you'd have to have a few of them before you would contemplate and redo it. You wouldn't do it for a particular chemical.
Right. In this case, we were redoing a lot of chemicals that had not officially been part of the list.
Going back to the issue we talked about when you're doing definitions, the health advisories, when you look at the way in which they're promulgated for some substances, there might be 5 or 6. And I know that you say that you're adopting the how, and maybe this is an unnecessarily simplified question, but which one of them are you adopting?
With respect to the EPA.
And basically, it says, and maybe it's not perfectly clear, but it does say, other primary drinking water health advisories are listed in the 2018 edition of the U.S. EPA. If MCL or HAL is not listed in documents referenced above in subparagraph 3 or 4, which basically references the MCLs and our HALs. So if we don't have an MCL or HAL, then we'll look at the EPA document.
And you wonder which column to use?
Well, it's a little disingenuous question. Mm-hmm. I know the answer to the question I'm asking, but I'm curious. For example, if you look at you got a 1 day and a 10 day for a child, then you've got an RFD based on carcinogenic for some substances, you've got a cancer based value, you've got a lifetime value that looks at the drinking water equivalent level and applies a relative source contribution if there is one. And then you've got a straight up cancer risk level, which mm-hmm. here is identified as being 10^-4.
Mm-hmm. That's their range.
Right.
But we convert it to what the state of Florida uses as their negligible risk number of 1 million.
Well, I think we can, and I guess maybe what you're asking is what do we use, and probably it should be put in there. We would use the lifetime value or the 10^-6 cancer risk, whichever.
Just to be more specific on what we're using.
Is that
by incorporating by reference right now creates confusion.
Right. I see what you're saying.
Not that we didn't know what you were doing, but we just want to make sure.
That's fine. Writing this stuff is difficult. I am finding out. It's not as easy as I used to rail about.
We can be more specific.
So I appreciate it.
If it is a carcinogen, it would be a lifetime value that we're looking at on the most recent, which is March 2015, drinking water standards from the EPA.
That's what we're looking at.
Yeah. And if it's a non-carcinogen, then that would be, would it be the dwell column?
Well, it would be the dwell or the lifetime if it was an RNC.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So, and then that we would be utilizing a 1 in a million cancer risk.
Yeah, that's really where the question arose for us is, we knew what your intent was. Your intent wasn't to adopt it. 10^-4, but it sort of seemed like if you just adopted this and put it in by reference, that's what you would get.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point.
So we need to mention the statute that states that it's 10^-6 in Florida.
Yeah, and we do our standard is 10^-6, so yeah, and that's a good point to put in with the term. Make that clarification. And that would be...
I don't have anything else for quorum.
Okay. Well, let me kind of go down unless anybody else has any questions.
While we're on risk.
While we're on risk and
the how, anybody on the phone want to speak up?
Who is on the phone?
You're all unmuted.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All unmuted.
Anyone in the audience on the telephone wish to speak up now about the howls?
This is Joe Yulo. I don't have anything to add. Thank you.
Okay.
That's from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection.
Okay. Great. Okay. Next step, we have kind of tweaked the definition of limited-use public water system. Now, that is in the statute, so we can't do a whole lot with it, but we're trying to make this a little bit clearer, primarily for, is the system limited use? Is this a DEP regulated system, or is it a private system? Excuse me. And primarily, we just simply said that it's, you know, just, we've added that it provides pipe water to the public, and it's not private, which makes perfect sense to me. We have removed oral consumption as a definition and broken that out as a separate definition to specify that that doesn't include food or beverage processing. We have a definition for maximum contaminant level, but no, certainly nothing adopted. Multifamily water systems, just tweaked some of the language on that, trying to make it clear. As I said, we added oral consumption as a separate definition that was previously in. We just pulled it out and enumerated it. Definition of private water system, which should be straight from the statute. Definition of rental residence. That's we have used a lot from the DPPPR for DACs as well as what a rental residence is. Versus it's a private home or you're renting it out. So that goes down most of it. Any comments on section one? Any questions? Section number two, construction. I think the only changes we made there were just making changes to the address.
Before you leave the definition,
you're
talking about one item on the definition, and it's, you don't propose a change in the definition of MCL.
No, we do not.
But MCL, as it's defined, is something that you may want to look at, because I think when you use MCL in this rule, you're referring to the MCLs created by DEP in 62-550, correct?
Mm-hmm. In most
cases. To the extent that they're, well, I guess we've already talked about the federal MCLs are all incorporated in 62-550.
Yes.
So it creates confusion about what an MCL is under this rule. Can you determine that something exceeds a maximum permissible level without identifying what you're using to determine what's the permissible level?
If you go down to the section six, and we'll get to it, which is to make a quick jump ahead, we do have a monitoring and water quality standards in section six. And
well,
one.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah.
We have questions on that.
And it does mention the, and it does call out the MCLs and does reference the rule at that point.
Right.
But it also, the only ones that, and I don't know, I think they may be the same, as in, it does call out lead and nitrates separately as MCLs within the bounds of this rule, and then pretty much adopts the DEP 550, say 62-550s for any.
Yeah, it just creates confusion in the rule. If you have an opportunity to change it, you may want to consider whether it's appropriate to clean up the definition of MCL in M1.
And we do have an opportunity.
Yes.
But let me take that one step further. Since you used the example of lead, I know that in a practical sense, everybody uses the action level as though it were an MCL.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't really an MCL.
Right. And in this particular statute, now this is for limited use systems, and it only applies to limited use systems, then, yeah, we do take that action level very much as an MCL. It's treated as such. Now, these are, they're not, you don't have the massive distribution systems like you would. And
I guess all I'm pointing out is that if someone didn't have your best interest at heart and you ask the rule like it is, they might say, it isn't an MCL. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've actually, and maybe we can clarify that, because it is kind of defined as an MCL here in Section 6. So.
The
trick of that is, as an action level, we only take one sample from one of these limited-use public water systems, and so that becomes the action level and the MCL. Now, we could reword it, but they're all taking one sample. There's 9,000 of these permitted in Florida.
I guess we would only point out that it isn't really that, but
it's not in the federal requirement.
The action level.
It has become an MCL because we wrote it this way in 2008, and even before then in 93,
okay.
We called it an MCL.
Okay.
But you're right. We could clarify that.
I didn't realize that it was already codified in Florida law that it would be that.
Yeah.
Florida rule, not law.
Yeah, just in this rule. It would not apply to a state drinking water act system, for instance. That would be the federal. That's about the federal rule. So for limited use, which are the smaller systems, less than 25 people per day, then yes, it is basically codified as an MCL.
So the difference between this and the double problem I'm not getting, the difference between municipal water supply.
Yes,
we don't regulate the municipal water supplies. That's DEP that regulates them, and we regulate limited use systems. And we do help with private wells, but the regulation piece is the limited use system.
Okay. Most of these are for duplexes, triplexes, quadruplexes, small mobile home parks with fewer than 15 connections. We have, like I said, 9,000 that are process permits and have a quarterly bacteria requirements and the lead and nitrate every 3 to 5 years.
With respect to that distinction, is there an intent in this rule to require those limited use systems to meet requirements that would be more burdensome than what's required by DEP for municipal or public potable systems?
No, they're not required to monitor for these in most cases, except for bacteriological lead and nitrate. Now, there are specific situations, where you may be required as part of the permit, but that's part of the permitting process. The reason we're putting those in here is if you do, for whatever reason, we do find it there, then we can say, hey, you have to do something about this. And so but it's not a normal monitoring requirement like it would be for a municipal system. These are really for, as Bob said, for triplexes and very, very small mom and pop type operations. So they don't have the requirements. It's a large requirement, but if we do find something, at least we can, that some action can be taken.
And in the rule itself, it says that if you're within 1,000 feet of a well that is contaminated with one of these chemicals, you need to test your well for this chemical, for this limited-use public water system. Doesn't apply, the regulation for permitting doesn't apply to private wells, it applies to these limited-use public wells. The private wells, we're using the Howell list to remediate those. Under both the Inland Protection Trust Fund and the Water Quality Assurance Trust Fund. The DEP's Office of Water Supply Restoration, putting those filters on or hooking them to city water. We've tested over 125,000 of them, and about 6,000 have been remediated.
So going on to that, and I think our comments are on 8.006.
Mm-hmm.
So we're skipping a lot, but
yeah,
I'm sure that anybody has comments
before
then.
We can
but in looking at, you've made one edit there to add a new level of, a new reference to health advisory levels, or MCLs actually, use HOCLA on it, in 2A5 that you have there. When you read the beginning of 2, it seems to suggest that if the analysis is not, must not exceed the following standards, that the actual regulated party would have to be analyzing the water for all of those constituents to determine whether it does.
I mean, for it to do that.
And so that was our question by the language that's used in two, would parties that are regulated by this rule be required to include in their water annual water quality analysis all of these?
No, unless there's a specific reason for it that's covered elsewhere in the rule.
So if you back up to section 0.04, just above 0.05, it says satisfactory water quality analysis results for the following: micromyological, a lead analysis, a nitrate analysis. Those are the compliance requirements.
Where is that?
It's
section 0.06. I'm sorry, 0.04. There you go. Mike's highlighting on the board. But those are the regulatory requirements, and then you have to search on the word 1,000 for 1,000 feet to see the one that says if you have a well contaminated within 1,000 feet, you need to run the test for that contaminant. Does that help?
Well, this is just the startup of the system, then.
Start up, and then there's some annual monitoring every 3 to 5 years, depending on whether it's commercial or community system. There's people live there, or people go to work there. And that is in there.
Well, but the problem is... you have the cross-reference 0.064 in D there. So if you say all they have to do is the microbiological analysis, the lead and nitrate, the next obligation in that same list is any satisfactory analysis required by 8.0064. And 8.0064 mm-hmm. is the drinking water house as listed in 64E.
Education was on these. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, I see.
Okay, here we are. Yeah, actually, if you go with to 6, we have a monitoring schedule. Section 3 is section 6, subsection 3. Monitoring schedule analysis of water samples for lead and nitrate required once every 36 months or every 60 months, depending on the system, and one microbiological sample. So that's actually covered down a little bit. If you're just focusing on that paragraph 2, perhaps a little bit, I can certainly see that might want to clarify that notch.
So, and it's 4 that pulled in if the well is within 1,000 feet of a contaminated well or known.
Yes.
There's the bottom.
Yeah, if we have a DEP delineated area for 1,000 feet of an uncontaminated source or otherwise required.
That raises the question of what are you testing for? Are you testing for everything for which there's a have?
No, it would be specific for whatever, if we're looking at these additional requirements. I mean, the basics, again, are bacteriological lead and nitrate. As far as any additional requirements, it would be known with the Department of Environmental Protection delineated area, and they basically tell you what you'd be sampling for in that area. There are some in 562.524, several, in fact. If the well is within 1,000 feet of a contaminated well or unknown contaminant source, if we know what the contamination is, they would have to at least pull a sample. It's not a, I don't believe it's an annual. I think it's just a one time.
That's what, but the last one is what takes you to 007, which takes you into the list of hows.
We'll just verify that. Yeah.
There's no intent to criticize your...
Oh, no, and that's fine. That's just,
but I work my way through, and I end up with a checklist of stuff that does.
We don't intend to do that.
Yeah, we don't. These are small systems, and we don't want to bankrupt them for certain. We're going to... And this has been our standard thing, so certainly we can write some clarifying language in there to make it, you know, that under normal circumstances, this is all you got to deal with, and everything else is special circumstances.
I think it's the link between that part B that takes you to 007.
Okay.
The
We've never implemented it that way, if that helps.
It does.
But yeah. So we'll clarify
it. It helps me.
Sure, we'll clarify that. And then 10 of that to capture the ones that are just out.
Do we lose them again?
I think we lost them again.
I think we did.
Okay, we're here, yeah, and we're still on here. We'll have to dial in again. We're going to have to tell AT&T that their system doesn't work. So we hear you.
Oh, boy. I apologize. We will be there back online a little bit, hopefully very shortly. So we'll work on that. Maybe we take five.
Sure, we can take a 5-minute break.
If I want to take a 5-minute break while we're working on this, the staff room's out there and water fountain stuff.
We will put you on mute until we come back. So 5-minute break.
We are on mute.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to
press my
Xbox.
I'm going
to
pick up on you.
There's another guy. I know you better take a note on me. Thank you. Going through its teething problems.
Yeah, you can hear it through there, so I don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
recording you on this still?
No, I'm
not recording you.
Hey, we're back. Okay, good. I heard myself coming through the cell phone, so it's good. Although disconcerting, but I'm hearing an echo. We were discussing at the end we kind of bounced to Section 6, that subsection 2, where we're discussing the requirements for sampling. Our intent is certainly that for the vast majority of these systems, the sampling is bacteriological lead and nitrate, unless there's a good reason for other things. We don't want to make them do the whole suite that a municipal water system would have to go through. So that's certainly, and we can certainly look to try and clarify that. Sort of part of the reason why we're here is to make these kind of changes so that it's a lot less confusing. So any other comments on that section? Okay. I'll kind of go roll back a little bit. Do we have any more comments on definitions? Anybody on the phone want to, any questions or comments on the definition section? We'll move on to construction, section 2. I think the only change we had there were some addresses and URLs. We're not... Nothing new. We did update the Title 21 Code of Federal Regulations from the 2007 to the 2017 variant and gave that a link as far as, and that is for food service, if I'm not mistaken, that's a food code. So we've updated our link to that.
That's for chemicals that might be used and equipment and material.
And so you want to use something, it has to follow that. And I think we've discussed maybe updating some of the forms. We've got copies over there if anybody wants to look at them. We're just changing. It's mostly wording changes. But they're certainly available for download and for review if anybody wants to comment on those. So while we're here, anybody on Section 2, anybody have any questions on that? Okay, Section 3, new primary and multifamily system construction. We're still on new construction here. Some changes from applicant to supplier, some wording changes. And I think that is really all we had, except that being, we do mention an updated form, which we need to make some no major changes. Again, over there on the table if anybody wants to see what we're proposing right now. Section 4, moving along. Wording changes. There's some minor changes, difference between the word comply and be in compliance. I think that's... Notice some changes on the address and, physical address and then website address, which have changed in the last 10 years. Section 5, operation and maintenance. Well, we're gone. Any questions, any comments on Section 4? Section 5, operation and maintenance, I think we're still, we changed the web page and, again, the physical mailing address. Section 6, I think we've gone over fairly well, but I'm going to go down talking about water quality samples. I guess what we've decided is the best way is to look at ways to clarify to make sure that it's understood what we're trying to get across with this. And we'll certainly take a look at that, and we'll certainly take suggestions from you all if you happen to have them. Talking down the adoption of the HAL list, so the EPA HALs and the state HAL, which is being updated, and the EPA HAL, we will specify the 10 and negative 6, make sure we're on that for the lifetime. So we'll make sure we had put that in there so that people will know. That really is, I think we've gone over that part of Section 6. Does anybody else have any comments on that while we're here? Okay, we'll move on to Section 7. I don't see a whole lot, a couple of ands or ors. I think that's it.
On 7.
7, correct.
Yeah, we have a couple of questions that I have that are not modified text, but there are questions about the text.
Okay.
So 007, friend 2. Says an acute risk to health exists when a chemical MCL or HAL violation occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some other language. But I have a couple questions that are related to that. When you say the phrase acute health risk, that means something very specific to me as a toxicologist. And it isn't in the definition section. And I wonder, does when you say that an acute health risk is defined by a violation of the HAL, a HAL violation. What does that mean?
You could just use the wording a risk rather than acute risk because it is.
And
acute is
something
acute
quite,
is very.
Yeah.
You could broaden that and just say a risk. Play with that language.
The concern is because a violation. For an exceedance of a HAL could conceivably be deemed to be a violation, right?
Mm-hmm.
If HAL is derived from a lifetime exposure scenario,
that's a chronic risk.
No, it
is
must.
Appropriate
I see what you're saying.
That as acute risk.
No.
What the original purpose of this was for bacteria or nitrate violations and we rarely saw HAL violations of limited use public systems, but we could, and we need to modify that to put in the chronic and give some time frame to get it corrected. So the question is then, do we have to tell the owner, you're good for 6 months drinking this water with a HAL violation, or are you good for a year, or are you good for 2 months? These are easily correctable things, especially on the scale of a limited use public water system. Carbon filtration, perhaps RO. Need to decide then how long we're going to give them for a HAL violation that is a chronic lifetime risk.
And work that out. I mean, we have some language in our memorandum of understanding between the two sister agencies that might could help.
Mm-hmm.
They won't limited use public water systems
okay.
anymore.
Okay.
They don't have the money in either of the two trust funds I mentioned. They need these up to the owner. These are public water systems that are for profit
mm-hmm.
in most cases. So we just need to decide how long we're going to look at it.
That's a temporal kind of a question.
Yeah.
For
disinfection byproducts, you know, EP often gives a year and sometimes 2 years to get things corrected. You can do that. You should write that into the rule.
The implication, of course, is, and I think it's resolved by that suggestion, it implies it's a public health hazard. And I think maybe you do mean that the phrase acute health risk means something very specific, probably more specific than you meant it to be.
We meant it to apply to fecal coliform and nitrate.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that would be.
And so, and it can, because you say or when a fecal coliform form MCL violation.
Yeah, I think we need to rewrite. I agree. I think
the introductory language that was with
yes.
Uh-huh.
It circles back around, though, to a question we talked about kind of right at the beginning, and that is the relationship between these documents, the rule, and the other work that you all do with respect to the same kind of systems of the APSDR work. And there are very specific things that have to do with acute health risks in this mm-hmm. chapter. And if they're equivalent to public health hazard, are they equivalent in the sense of what you mean when you say public health hazard for the health consultation? Is that too great a stretch, you think? Is that what you meant?
I think it's looking at it more than regulatory. We're trying to prevent getting to the point where we need to do a risk assessment. And certainly, as part of the idea behind regulatory, we're trying to, you know, as close to zero as we can reasonably, of course, get.
And the human health risk assessments are really advisory in nature, and they advise the regulatory agencies of the there may or may not be a health hazard depending on what the results are, and the parameters of where we see the hazards or how we see the hazards. So it's slightly different, regulatory versus advisory.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a fair point. Mm-hmm. And I could see it going in a circle where people want to equate public health hazard with acute health risk the way it's laid out. And I don't, again, I don't mean to tell you what your intent was. But I don't think
well, the difference between giving advice and then it's okay, it's your job to make that decision versus this is a regulatory rule right here where it's, you know, you have to, there's a line, and on this side you're good and on that side.
Well, the third component is the cleanup activities that the DEP does on these wells, the private wells that we use the same house for. So if your private well has atrazine in it, we have an MCL. If it has one of the other chemicals, the health advisory, they have the ability under the statute to put a filter or hook that citizen's well to the city water supply nearby. So there's really three pieces to this. There's our compliance with the limited use, there's the APSDR consideration, but then there's always the remediation program that is ongoing since 1986.
Fair enough. And I don't mean to beat the horse, but when you say acute.
No, I think you're right on that. I think the word acute is.
Well, all the PALs and MCLs are developed on lifetime.
Yeah, lifetime. And
not fecal bacteria and nitrate.
Yeah, and that is an acute.
So I think you're right. I guess it would be a longer sentence, but
we can separate those.
Yeah, they do. I agree. They do need to be called out because, you know, fecal coliform and nitrates and those need to be dealt with pretty much immediately versus something that we have a little more time on if it's a, as you say, if it's a 70-year, a lifetime issue. And so we certainly can put in some time on those HALs and determine, you know. But, yeah, I agree. Acute is probably not a problem. Something that's a 70-year.
So as you mentioned, too, though, there are some acute issues in the drinking water standards and health advisories of EPA for the 1 day and the 10 day. Reference that.
I think that's the value of those things. Those numerical values is that it contemplated the important part of the timing. Mm-hmm. It's not just the exposure, it's the question of how long was the exposure and how it's been. Mm-hmm. Which is, of course, the APSDR approach that we'll take. It's clear that it's designed to be an understanding of what the realistic risk is as opposed to the hypothetical risk mm-hmm. from a lifestyle exposure. The same question runs through a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as we said, we get more and better information, and this code goes back to starting in 90, we'll just go back to
93
you started. So, I mean, a lot of the information that informed this is.
I think that's good. The point about the difference between regulatory and advisory is enough, really.
Mm-hmm. So, Well, we do, yeah. And I think a lot of that is it is, but yes, I do agree with you. I think acute is probably, I mean, there are certain things we do want to call out. This is an acute mess to deal with. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can certainly believe, if you guys come up with some better suggestions as to how to word that, believe me, we will certainly take a look at it. And I don't mind stealing people's verbiage.
You know, you might not be surprised that our initial solution was to take the word out.
Yeah. I think it works out.
Can you...
state your name.
Yeah, this is...
Ed Deggins, your environmental consultant, Bureau of Environmental Health. Paragraph 2, where it says, when a fecal coliform, and just add or E. coli to make it consistent with 004.
Okay. Yeah, because I think E. coli is more of a standard, but I think fecal.
Yeah.
I think it's still written in the I think I went back and looked at 55. I think I'm kind of consistent with 550. Why don't you go back up to the definitions and say, if you could call the form, where's it going? But yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks.
Anything else for note 7?
Okay.
Well, tied to this same thing is in 10, where you've had it for failure to comply with the meet the standards established by this chapter as a prohibited act. So again, we get to the point of under this chapter, the violation, an exceedance of the how would be deemed to be a violation. Correct?
We have never interpreted that way.
But incorporating this provision,
We had other remediation methods for violations of OCLs and PALs previously, and we didn't think we needed it in the prohibited act, so we never included it.
I think it's basically, I mean, this is basically, if you're running one of these systems, you do have to comply with this, and in the end, you know, carrot and stick, you know, there are ways to, sometimes you do have to go the stick route.
But if you exceed a how only...
Yeah, that would
be considered to be in violation.
The first thing to do would be to correct the how.
I think number 6 there, the failure to comply with or meet the standards established by this chapter would apply to that how violation.
And because there are rules, if you have a how, if you have an exceedance, you have to do this, 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 and this. Mm-hmm. If you fail to do that, then yes, that can be a violation.
So that's my... My question. My question goes to that.
Yeah, we're not.
So that makes how a how, and as best as we can tell from our researching just that word in all of Florida Administrative Code, this section is the only section that uses that term.
Up to three level.
In any department, in any regulatory program currently published in the Florida Administrative Code. So,
because that's one of our roles as a Department of Health is advisory.
So if the intent, though, in this rule is to make the HAL an enforceable standard for the entities that you regulate, recognizing that the HAL is not an enforceable standard pursuant to Chapter 62550 or DEP's regulation of potable water supply systems not regulated by DOH, then wouldn't the effect of that be that you are imposing standards on your regulated community greater than the standards that are imposed on larger water suppliers?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because there is a section in 550, section 521, that does talk about unregulated contaminants. They don't use the term how. But they do reference, and I have a blurb of it here, and sorry, I didn't put it down, but it is in 550, it's section 521. And it says, in part...
550.521?
0.521, yes. If the presence of a contaminant is determined by the state health officer and the department, and that would be state health officer, that would be Department of Health and the Department of Environmental Protection, to constitute an unreasonable risk to health, corrective action, including additional monitoring, shall be taken by the supplier of water as approved by the department. So they do use that HAL list to determine whether that's unreasonable or not, and we could consult in some of these cases. If, again, a situation where they're not required to monitor for some of these things, but if it comes up, they're going to be talking with us. And if they do find it, they can mandate that that utility take action to get rid of the risk. They're just not going to ignore it. And that's sort of that's the same principle we have here. We're not mandating that these people routinely monitor for these HALs. But if we find it, we really can't walk away and ignore it. Because, that is our job, is to determine whether it is an unreasonable risk. And they're determined effectively the same way as the MCL.
And between the two agencies, this is Kendra, we do have a legal memorandum of understanding that we've had in place for some time that kind of goes through that. How many?
Mm-hmm.
Six years.
Mm-hmm.
So, Doug, responding to your comment, Mike, on 550.521,
mm-hmm.
does the Department of Health then deem a violation of a health advisory level to constitute an unreasonable risk to health?
That is a risk.
That term is used in 550.5.
In the same way that an MCL would constitute an unreasonable risk.
Yeah,
good
idea.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you produce health consultation reports for the benefit of the public, to notify the public whether or not they are exposed to an unreasonable health risk, that have in some circumstances evaluated concentrations of contaminants that are three times the HAL, and have concluded that there are no public health risks.
And these are by drinking water?
Yes. So how do you reconcile that?
And I think that, this is Kendra, I think that goes back to the way that you are looking at the input for the health advisories, or not the health advisories, but the health assessments. In some of those, we are looking at a central tendency estimate of intake, or not a maximum residential time. I don't think that comes into play here with drinking water, but we're not looking at a daily exposure like we are with the health advisory levels. So it's a different look at the information. And these are regulatory in nature versus advisory, the health assessments, and getting to a more site-specific scenario for those health assessments. Versus when you're looking at cleanup target levels, or if you're looking at health advisory levels, you don't have the luxury sometimes of, here's your standard, I'm going to compare it to it. You might not have, at the time, a specific site in mind. So they're kind of they're different in the way that they approach things. I don't know if that...
Well, the confusion that I think would be created by the regulated community is... I hope that wasn't a personal comment there.
No, my watch was telling me it is 2:34 in a Minnie Mouse voice. So, okay. Sorry.
The confusion for the public is when you read the health consultation reports, they reference being produced under the cooperative agreement with ATSDR. And my experience with them has been they're used for the purpose of determining whether you notify the public of a risk or not. And if you conclude that there's not a public health risk, there's not a formal notification process. But if you conclude there is a public health risk, there's a notification process. And in reporting to AS, EDR on those health consultation reports, and you provide your quarterly reports or whatever, like I'm aware of at least one quarterly report where you identified this work as a success story for advising ATSDR that you determine that there's no lifetime risk based upon the work that you did in the health consultation report. So if there's no lifetime risk as concluded in those health consultation reports and as reported to ATSDR as a success story in one of your quarterly reports, how is it that a violation of that or an exceedance of that number could create a health risk in a program where you regulate the providers? I think that's the disconnect that I'm struggling with.
And very quickly, we have to kind of move on, but I mean, my understanding is the difference between, all right, you're responsible for providing water to these people versus you've been exposed. Here's what, you know, we think is going to happen. We can't say you're providing some level of risk to these people. We know there's a risk, but it's okay.
We have to make sure they have safe water. And so we can't ignore that.
Maybe you concluded that they do have safe water at the end of the health consultation. You concluded that they do have safe water?
So the snapshot and the variables that we look at.
Did they cut us off again?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah,
and I know that was a short one. Sure. I know. It keeps getting shorter and shorter the time, but this will stay online and you can hear people in the room. So we're going to take a minute and get back online.
Hold that thought.
Welcome to SunCom Reservation List Conferencing. Please enter your passcode followed by the pound sign. One, see your call. 200. After the tone, please state your name followed by the pound sign. This call is being recorded by the meeting organizer. By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to be recorded.
Okay, let's try it again. Mark, you know.
This is Mark Higginbotham of the Department of Health. I don't see an answer to the three times the how violation question, three times the exceedance, but aren't the health assessments, which I've done a few, aren't they trying to standardize the approach to and do the exact opposite of what you suggested, which is to individualize and give special circumstances to each individual site? I'm not saying that's not the right approach, but isn't that the purpose of the guidance handed down from federal authorities is to provide a method that can be standardized and done in a less expensive manner, you know, that doesn't have years and years of individualized procedure that costs exorbitant amount of money that can't be realized practically?
I think the confusion
it's not an excuse, it's just an observation. It seems like
you have a cooperative agreement with ATSDR that requires you to
that's not a regulatory thing. I think
it comes into play because under this regulation, an exceedance of the how would now be determined to be a violation under your new language and would subject the user to enforcement.
Not the user, the owner.
I mean the provider, sorry.
The owner.
Yeah. So I think it is relevant to this, and so it seems to me like by referencing 521, the suggestion is that the intent of that the Department of Health now would conclude that where a HAL is exceeded, that constitutes an unreasonable risk, when in fact you've done health consultations that state otherwise.
Again, the health consultation, we know what the exposure was, or at least have an idea of the exposure. This is somebody providing sort of, shall we say, a new exposure path, and that's a no-no. Or, you know, I'm sorry, I understand you got exposed, and here's what your risk is. We're not going to say it's okay for somebody to go ahead. I'm not going to let you expose somebody to something above the HAL just because we said, well, these guys were exposed for 5 years to something above the HAL. Chances are they're going to be okay. And that their chances, their risk is very low. And of course, these HALs are intentionally low. They are very conservative numbers. They are incredibly conservative numbers, as you well know. And so that's the point. We're not going to, you know, we're trying to keep this down to as close to zero as we can. Once the exposure has been made, well, then we have to come up with a site-specific risk assessment. And then we could say, okay, you have incredibly high risk or you have very low risk, even though it was over that level. Because these are deliberately conservative numbers.
But the health consultation reports are based upon a lifetime of exposure, not 5 years, not 3 years.
Yeah, this is regulatory, though. I think we're going to have to, if you put that, yeah, separate the two.
It concerns
some negligible risk number that you say is, that's my unacceptable risk in the regulatory world. We say that in our regulatory world is one in a million risk. But in the grand scheme of things, we know that EPA also tells us, as states, that negligible risk can be a range of things, anywhere from 1 in 10,000 all the way down to the 1 in a million risk. The state of Florida has chosen in their regulatory world to say 1 in a million risk is what we accept as a state as negligible risk. We all have those same boundaries in the non-advisory APSDR program, and the role there is to educate the public of really what realistically could happen. So there is a difference in the way that non-advisory program approaches things and the way that the regulatory world has to approach things, because we are saying that we can't, because as a state, we've chosen a one in a million risk. We can't have someone continue to violate that one in a million risk and knowingly have them violate.
But making the HAL a regulatory standard in this rule for the users, for the suppliers that you regulate with these changes, you are, in effect, creating a regulatory program that is more stringent than the program that currently is imposed on larger municipal.
It's the same. See, it's the same point again. There are certain things that you have to monitor for under certain circumstances. You may find that there's something there that exceeds something that's not on an MCL, and that is for these small limited use systems. And that's the same as for the big municipal systems. We've seen it happen, where they have something that is not on that MCL list, it's in their water, it is over 1 times 10 to the negative 6, and DEP comes in and says, you have to do something to fix this. Thou shalt, you know. And that is the whole purpose of 521.
And I think there's a fine line between what we're talking about, non-enforceable standards versus enforceable standards, and that, I think this becomes down to a legal definition, or a legal question of our...
And again, when you're doing regulation, we don't have the flexibility of, you know, a non-regulatory advisory program. If we are saying that, you know, this is, you're not going to put this in the water.
My question to Kendra, you may have misspoken when you said it's a non-advisory advisory program.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I didn't speak.
Thank you.
No,
let me just say that the reason, this is Bob Vincent, the reason we created this HAL is for the remediation program, for the thousands of potentially contaminated private wells out there. That's why we have this list. We need a number in the rule because the rule references our HAL list as well.
we're not considering public health assessments under ATSDR under this rule. We're only using it in our sense for this regulation and for the remediation of those private wells. The numbers can be used in the assessment, but they're optional.
One is a different way of looking at, whereas with health, you are solving for a concentration that you do not want to exceed based upon the negligible risk number of one in a million, versus with the health assessment, it's a different rearrangement of the formula where you have a concentration and you are wanting to know what the risk range is. And so
What's your current risk when you're trying to decide that there's not a significant risk based on that?
What was that?
1 in 6, right?
It is anywhere from 1 in 10,000 down to 1 in a million. That's the range, that flexibility of what negligible risk is and what public education type, more our risk, not risk assessment, but risk communication more than these are standards that we are working with.
So that's written into the EPA health advisory group on the forum, and I think that there's in the ATSDR conference that they've got that range. But we don't have that range in state regulatory issues, and we don't have that range in the remediation of private wells. So it's a legal issue. It's in the statute.
No, I understand that. My comments are all based upon situations where the evaluation was performed using a 1 × 10⁻⁶. And so the health consultation reports, even though a HAL was exceeded, concluded that the risk was below 1 × 10⁻⁶, even though the concentration exceeded the HAL.
And then that one that you're talking about, that particular one, I know that we only looked at the central tendency ingestion, whereas when we're looking at health advisory levels, we're looking at the maximum ingestion. The parameters are slightly different, and it's more flexible with the ATSDR versus we try to use a very similar formula for all of the calculations. Unless we have something different from the Office of Water that we've explained at EPA.
So I'm just suggesting it creates confusion because I'm aware of at least two circumstances where the evaluation was performed and a determination was made on private wells that a HAL was exceeded, but there was no health risk. But DOH made a determination of health risk, and there was no recommendation for the private users. So if a private user is being told under those circumstances you have no health risk or a HAL is exceeded, and then you have a supplier that's subject to this rule being told that if you have any concentration in excess of a HAL, you're violating a regulatory level and you're subject to the corrective action and enforcement provisions of this rule.
The supplier is, that's part of getting a permit. You will, here's the list, and that's it, as opposed to a private situation. I mean, if you're looking at that, if you're going to put those together, it goes back to English common law. I can give you recommendations. There is no HAL for a private well. Here's what our recommendation is. And you may say, if you've had a risk at this level, your family, you're drinking a liter a day, well, our estimates are 2 liters a day, that's going to change those numbers. But again, this is calculated the same way that an MCL would be calculated, or a GCTL, effectively the same way. And we have to, and then the risk number calculated, or and the numbers chosen in most cases is that 2 liters, unless we have a very, very good reason, like we do with PFOA, PFOS, to add those. They're very conservative. And again, this is the supplier of the water versus the person who's getting it. And we're not, the supplier is going to be treated much more conservatively. because of it. I mean, we just, I can't say, it's okay for you to violate this level. It's no, we really can't do that.
So we're not confused.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I think, you know, but it's, I think it's the difference between, you know, here's what we have, a site-specific instance, and again, 9,000 is a lot of systems in the state of Florida, and we have to come up with a number. And those are the numbers that are used, and they're similar to calculated the same way that the EPA would calculate, the same way that the DEP would calculate.
Then just a final follow-up question on that. Then the house, all of the chemicals that are on this March 23, 2018 list,
mm-hmm.
the formulas used to calculate those HALs are the same formula that DEP uses to establish GCTL?
For the most part, I believe they are.
At the moment, it might be.
Unless.
But we really based ours on the EPA's Safe Drinking Water Act because, you know, in some cases we're in delegated authority and or we say indifferent. I mean, it's similar right now.
Again, there are some ones that we filled out, PFOA, so on about some of those where we used ADAP. I don't think those were very commonly used previously, and we followed the EPA's lead on those. And so, but basically, by and large, the vast majority of them has a lot of the same assumptions and the same. Now, it may change in the future. It's effectively what, you know, EPA has done. That's what Office of Water is still using, that 2 liters per day and 70 kilogram average body weight, which is what we use. And I know their Office of Pesticides uses a slightly different body weight and different ingestion rate, but you know, we're being consistent with what EPA is doing.
So if the HAP was calculated in this particular concentration, and then you have identified a concentration greater than that, isn't that one part per billion over the number, three times the number. What you're doing on the one hand is telling people it's okay. And on the other hand, you're telling people it's not okay. I'm having a hard time. I mean, it's not that there's no explanation for it. I heard what you said. Mm-hmm. It just seems like a peculiar thing to try to persuade someone else.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm certainly not the expert in this assessment. I can tell you that if it's found in a regulatory system, or if it's found through a well surveillance program, it gets handled. I mean, we can say I'm perfectly okay saying this is a lifetime exposure calculation, and you know, so a short term exposure is probably okay, and the Department of Environmental Protection will put a filter on your well, or they will connect you to a central water system. And that's what we do in part of well surveillance. And, of course, if it's the supplier of water, you are over how you have to do something about this. Now, whether that's, you know, what mechanism to bring that down below the how we can discuss, and county health department can discuss with the supplier. And the same as a municipality system. You have an MCL or a how, you're exceeding that. You know, you have to do something about that. Now, a lot of that is open to finding, depending on what the how is and how much it is, as you say, but yeah, they would have to. Now, if it's a private well, I can't say you have to. I can tell them, no, we can recommend you do this, but.
Well, your risk communication strategy is going to be to tell the people that are actually using it.
So,
okay.
So aren't we, though, dealing with a statute in Florida or regulations and for remediation?
Sure, but there's obviously two different ways to get to 7-1.
And APMDR and EPA look at risk between 10⁻⁴ and 10⁻⁶. So therein lies the difference. You're right. And it would be nice if the legislature were to correct that and say to us, we're going to do everything on 10⁻⁶.
But it's not that you're violating 10⁻⁶. Because the health consultation report is identifying a risk as it is. So it's not... It's transcripts the issue. It's when you have a number, both of which is data below 10⁻⁶, and one is 3 times the other, how do you tell people in one circumstance it's okay, and in that same circumstance you're going to say it's not okay? I don't think we're going to get an answer today. It just seems hard to recognize.
It's occurred twice, though.
A couple times. Twice. And maybe three.
Well, for one constituent, we don't know. For others.
I mean, you can certainly bring that up, and I don't know. And, of course, that was not something that I'm perfectly familiar with. This is APMCR reports. I know they exist, and I've read some of them. Well, they don't have them. Yeah, so I can't really care. But, you know, I can't say that this is how our house was calculated. And that's based on that number. And, you know, again, we thought the
I think we're just looking at potential uncertainty or inconsistency or different. It's inconsistent in the way in which the information is being projected. Not that inconsistent about what you're doing. It's just that they're within, just like within EPA, you'll find inconsistent programs, inconsistent decisions, consistent guidelines. I don't know how to reconcile it, but they somehow do.
Remember, it's very rare to use these HAL-listed chemicals for 64E8 compliant. It's very common to use it for the remediation, and that's why we're changing it so that we can have a current number for remediation with the two cleanup programs. Protection and the water quality assurance protection system. We have to put it in the code according to the attorneys, and that's where we're going with this. It's not uncommon. Like I said, we've tested 125,000 private wells, and 6,000 were either contaminated by an MCL or a HAL, and those HALs need to change with science. That's what we're doing here. Two or three incidences don't occur correctly, I think that's a good thing. I've seen a lot more than that with other problems.
Well, if we can move on, any other comments on Section 7? I think that's where we were.
Yeah,
okay. And then Section 8, public health notification. I don't think we need any changes there. Section 9 on variances. I don't see any major changes there other than addresses.
Okay, your environmental health.
Mm-hmm.
We recently revised program policy manual for variances. And for your paragraph C for emergency approvals for the county health department.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure our language is in sync with both of those.
Okay. Take a look at that. That's fine. Out. So the line is the variance. Section 10, prohibited acts. I think we talked about 6 and 7. Any other comments on the prohibited acts? Anything that's... Okay. Section 12, schedule of fines. I think the only real changes there. You know, the only real changes were just to take out the methanol. And then cross-connection control, we're adopting the fourth edition of the American Water Works Association manual. So, any comments on that for anybody? Any comments on anything we caught on the phone out there? We've been pretty quiet, so most people have been listening in. I hope so.
We are. I can hear it.
Okay, good. So, anything else? Go to the order.
So 30 days is enough time for written comments?
If anybody wants to send them in, you can send them to me, my business cards over there. You can certainly send them via email. Wrap-up language. I don't have any wrap-up language, at least nothing in here. So, I can do that. But thank you all for coming. I do appreciate it. We got a lot of really good information on this. So I really, really do appreciate everything you guys have said. And if you have any questions or any follow-up responses, Mike, like I said, I have my business cards over there. You can certainly shoot me an email. Thank you very much, all. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your
patience. No, I appreciate it.